Counsel for the appellant in this case is also going to appear by WebEx. Mr. Astley, are you with us today?
Good morning, Your Honor. I am. Thank you.
Very good. And Ms. Rasmussen, you are here in court. Do either counsel have any questions before we begin?
No, sir.
Thank you very much. Mr. Astley, then you may proceed.
Well, thank you, Your Honor. Good morning to the Chief Justice and members of the court. May it please the court, I'm Adam Astley, and I have the pleasure of representing the appellant, Mark Becker, in this case today. Before I continue, I would like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal. There are some very important and somewhat interesting legal issues that are before the court in this appeal today, but before I get to them, I want to spend just a brief moment reminding the court of where we are and how we got to be here. Right after this court issued its published opinion in what I call Becker 1, the first published opinion from this court, and not counting the Court of Appeals opinion as a numbered opinion, right after this court issued its published opinion in Becker 1, Mark's phone rang, and on the other end of the phone was his daughter, Christina, a teenager with whom he had not had any meaningful contact in 2 to 3 years. Now, Mark did the exact same thing that I think any father under those circumstances would do. He answered the call. And when his daughter asked him to go have lunch to discuss her situation, he took her to lunch. And after that conversation, when his daughter asked him to have dinner and to continue to see him, he honored those requests. And he was so excited because for the first time in 2 to 3 years, he was beginning the very early steps of a very long process to fix a very broken relationship with his teenage daughter. And all of a sudden, out of the clear blue, after a few days of that, it all stopped. There was radio silence. Christina stopped calling. She stopped taking his calls. She stopped responding to his text messages, and he had absolutely no idea what had happened. And it took several weeks to figure out what had happened. And as it turns out, Mark's ex-wife, Sonia Becker, hired a youth transport service to pick up Christina in the middle of the night, drive her to the Omaha airport, put her on a plane, fly her to Las Vegas, and then drive her to a wilderness camp in the middle of the Utah desert, all without so much as informing her father where she was or what was going on. This was done without any referral from any medical provider, without any evidence of any medical need. This was simply something that Sonia Becker got the idea to do from talking to people at dance. She found a facility on the internet, and on the basis of the online positive reviews, she decided this is what she was going to do. So Mark then did what I think any reasonable litigant would do. He called his lawyers and he asked for advice. He secured a court order from the district court to give him some compulsory parenting time and phone contact with Christina. And unfortunately, there were some procedural issues with that order, as this court found, because this court found it was appropriate to reverse that order in Becker 2. He then pursued Sonia for contempt of court under essentially the notice clauses in the decree. And Sonia mounted a defense, the key of which was that Christina, the daughter, was not ill or injured, and she didn't suffer a medical problem. She testified to that. Her lawyer made that argument in her written closing argument, which we offered as evidence, and the court adopted that in its written order, found at pages 210 to 217 of the original transcript.
The written order in Mark's contempt proceeding is an issue that's in dispute between the parties about whether we can consider that, correct?
The appellee has raised a question of whether this court can consider items, I suppose, outside of the operative application for contempt and final order. And that is something with which we take serious issue.
Did you ask the district court at the hearing on Sonia's contempt application to take judicial notice of the order that was entered following the hearing on Mark's contempt application?
Of its own order at that hearing, no. I believe I'm talking to Justice Papik, but I'm having a hard time on the grid view. We didn't do that for a very simple reason, which is that when we prepped the case, We thought we were going to finish on a certain day. That order hadn't even been issued because the two cases were kind of leapfrogging each other. And the issue of whether Sonia was in contempt for taking Christina to the wilderness camp was still under advisement. So we prepped the case and we offered the only evidence that we had available to us, which was the closing argument. So we were able to show the court in evidence that Sonia had unequivocally asserted the position. We just hadn't got to the point where we were able to show the court that that assertion was successful. And then we did come back for another day. But just because of the way that this is leapfrogging and all of the issues in this case, we did not go that extra step and bring that order in and ask the court to take judicial notice of the order it had signed between the same parties in the same case.
Did the district court have the did you present the judicial estoppel argument that you're presenting now on appeal to the district court?
Yes, sir, we did. We presented that in our written closings. I asked—
Is that part of our record?
It's not, and I'm a little bitter about that. I went back to the district court because those written closings weren't filed with the clerk. They weren't offered into evidence. They were submitted after the fact. I went back to the district court and I filed a motion to supplement the appellate record to include those written closings. And the district court, after a very long and painful hearing, decided it was not comfortable doing that. I even offered the district court the option of simply certifying that the closings that we had provided to it were accurate copies so that then this court could decide whether to grant us leave under the appellate rules to supplement the record. And the district court was not even comfortable doing that. But I don't think it matters because judicial estoppel is not the type of thing that can be waived. It's there for the protection of the integrity of the system as a whole. It's there to prevent somebody from asserting that. I mean, I don't want a burden dump on the district court and say that the district court should raise that issue on its own, but it certainly shouldn't be our burden to prove that we raised it, even though, you know, obviously without having a reference to the record, Your Honor, I'm telling you that we did. So unless there are any other questions on the judicial estoppel issue in the wilderness camp, I think the court would probably benefit from a discussion on the purge plan and the keys to one's own jail cell. And like I say, there's a number of very important issues in this case, and unfortunately too much to really thoroughly cover it with the limited time we have here. But in terms of the purge plan, we are taking issue with subparagraph E of the purge plan, which requires Mark, upon pain of jail time, to pay within 10 days any medical expense that is properly presented to him by Sonia Becker anytime between the date of the order and when the child Susanna turns 19. Now, I'm not apprised of Susanna's exact birthday, but she was born in 2008. So on the date that this order was signed, this was approximately a 7-year purge plan. We feel that this runs afoul of the existing doctrine that the contemnor must hold the keys to their own jail cell. In its prior case law, this court has held that in order for the contemnor to hold the keys to their jail cell, that they need to know exactly what is necessary for them to have their freedom. And that means that it has to be explicitly spelled out in the order. You have to pay this amount or you have to do these things and you'll be released from confinement. We feel as though it's problematic for the district court to allow Sonia to control what those conditions are by allowing her to submit any expense that she wants, provided that she believes it's properly reimbursable under the decree. And because of that, we feel as though this purge plan is simply a bridge too far. It's a violation of that doctrine. And unless the court has any questions on that issue, I would reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Okay, I'll reserve my time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Rasmussen, good morning to you. And you may proceed.
May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Sally Rasmussen. I represent the appellee, Sonia Becker. This is a rather routine contempt of court case. Mr. Becker characterizes it in his brief as a matter of first impression. He invites the court to depart from a century of well-reasoned law This is not a case of first impression, and the court should decline Mr. Becker's invitation to depart from its prior precedent. The standard of review in a civil contempt proceeding is that questions of law are reviewed de novo. Factual findings are reviewed for clear error. Clear error occurs when a viewing court finds that a trial judge's decision is unquestionably erroneous. Determinations of whether a party is in contempt and the sanction to be imposed are reviewed by this court for abuse of discretion. Abuse occurs when a trial judge's decisions are untenable or unreasonable, clearly against justice or conscience, reason, and evidence. In order for an appellate court, this court, to review a trial judge's orders for clear error or abuse of discretion, the appellate court must look only to the evidence that was placed before the trial court in making the decision. Mr. Becker has asked this court to consider on appeal what the trial court could have considered. If this proposition is accepted by the court, an appellate review will cease to be a review of what actually happened at the trial court level and become a review of what could have happened at the trial court level.
So the material with respect to the wilderness camp that you contend shouldn't be considered is what? Primarily the court's order on Mark's contempt application?
The bill of exceptions for, I believe it was 2 days of trial on Mr. Becker's contempt action, was available at the time of this trial. It was not offered into evidence during this trial, even though
a brief was offered, though, correct? Closing argument.
There was a, the court had requested closing arguments from the parties, written closing arguments, and those were submitted in the prior trial. But briefs aren't evidence. This court has ruled repeatedly, briefs aren't evidence. They're a position asserted by one of the parties. And it is, the focus is on what the court actually ordered. What did the court order? What did the court find? And in this case, Mr. Becker, even though that order had been entered by the time we completed the trial that is now on appeal, he still did not ask the court to take judicial notice of that order. And he did not mark and offer the bill of exceptions, which is what he's brought up in this case. I'm not sure he even brought the order up in this case. He brought the bill of exceptions with the testimony of the parties in the prior action.
I beg your pardon. This is Justice Miller Lerman. Could you clarify for us what prior orders did or did not say with respect to extracurricular activities and how those are to be shared?
I'm not sure that we have a decree or an order that addresses extracurricular activities at all. We have a decree in place in this case that prohibits Mark Becker from having contact with his daughter Christina during the entire summer. That's what we have in this case. And that order has been in effect since this court affirmed it.
If we disagree,
I beg your pardon, was there any reference to extracurricular activities in any of the older orders, referring to things like medicals and tuition and extracurriculars and things of that nature?
We have, Justice Miller Lerman, in this case, also a decree that appears to incorporate a parenting plan attached to the decree, but states that any discrepancies between the parenting plan and the decree are governed by the decree, the provisions in the decree. And some of those provisions do not match up. And so one of them I'm thinking of is that if there is a disagreement over major decisions, medical, schooling, religion, then the parent with the custody shall make all of those decisions. And custody in the decree was given to my client of the two girls. And in the parenting plan, there was a joint custody for one of the children. So the position is that, for instance, that is on medical decisions. If I'm answering the question you're asking, mom makes those decisions if there's any disagreement. But in this case, Mr. Becker is not allowed contact with the child anyway.
What if the child contacts dad first?
Correct. And so all of the prefatory comments by Mr. Astley are outside the record. But to respond to your question, Chief Justice, if the child contacts the parent, the decree says the parent shall decline the invitation to communicate. That's what should happen. That it didn't happen. Mom didn't know that that communication occurred, and she was on a runaway at that point and did not know where the child was.
Assume for just a moment that we disagree with you on the record and everything that is in our bill of exceptions we can consider.
I can address that, Your Honor.
So, and particularly with respect to the wilderness camp, didn't Sonia take inconsistent positions in the two contempt proceedings?
She did not, Your Honor. She took very consistent positions.
Tell me how you get there.
Yes. So first of all, litigated in both cases, and everybody in that courtroom knew exactly what Wingate was. They knew what services were being provided. They knew where it was. Everybody in the court, there was no confusion at all over what services were being provided to the child at Wingate. What Sonia Becker testified to at the first trial was Wingate is for children with behavior problems and addictions. Wingate is not for illnesses or injuries. That's how she described it when she was asked. At the second trial,
but didn't you take the position in line with the language of the decree that there was no medical problem?
Yes, but in the context of that case, whatever was being litigated in that case, yes. So if that bill of exceptions had been brought into this case, we would have had the opportunity.
And I'm assuming it's all in front of us right now.
Okay, so if all of that's in front of you, then we've been denied the ability because we didn't know that.
What I'm trying to understand is it seems like at the first contempt proceeding, your client's position is there's no medical problem here. We don't have to notify Mr. Becker. And it seems like your position in the second proceeding is while there wasn't a medical problem, it is a medical expense and Mr. Becker has to pay. And those positions seem at least in tension.
Right. So each time in each trial, when there was testimony about what services were provided by it, it was in that context. And so in the second one, the judge said, this case involves a behavioral health issue, not a broken arm. Correct. That's consistent with what was testified to first. So is it? And remember, it was a contempt in the first case. So the issue was it willful violation of a court order if my client didn't understand what that meaning was? And it wasn't even brought up that, it wasn't even that issue in that case. So you have to have the context and how this court cannot review the trial judge's decision in this case. And if you're going to bring in other trials that this court didn't consider that bill of exceptions. This court didn't consider its prior order. This court didn't do any of that. How do you judge whether he's committed clear error or an abuse of discretion if you are considering facts that were not presented to him that turns appellate review on its head? Because from now on, we won't know what other bills of exceptions might be put into the appellate record when they were not properly introduced into evidence at the trial court level. It gives us an opportunity to put her on the stand and say, please explain your comments. What did you testify to? Why did you testify to that? What is your understanding? But there was no confusion in the courtroom at all about what services. And so if the first order is the issue, appeal it. But it wasn't appealed.
I think the issue your opponent is taking is that you're taking positions that benefit you, but changing them along the way, and judicial estoppel exists to prevent.
Yes, I understand that's the argument, but when you look at what was actually said, it was behavioral. I think there was psychological mention. There was, well, she had a broken soul, but she didn't have broken legs. You know, my client was trying to explain what the services were and what they weren't. And in both contexts, she explained that. So she explained it, and she explained it consistently. How do we know those are medical expenses? And Mr. Becker knew they were medical expenses. He cashed and he retained over $25,000 in medical reimbursement checks from the insurance company. Those were for mental and behavioral health expenses under the broad umbrella of medical. If he believed those expenses were not medical, why did he retain over $25,000 in reimbursement monies for them? Mental and behavioral health expenses had been submitted to Mr. Becker in the past, and he had paid them.
So did your client pay for the wilderness camp up front and then submit it to the health insurer after the fact?
That is correct. She had to pay up front in full. And then later, after the child had returned home, she submitted everything to the insurance company, which was paying 75%.
And until it was terminated. They sent the check to
the policyholder, Mr. Becker. Yes. And the last thing is, their decree in this case assumes that these types of expenses are under the umbrella of medical. That decree says when the parties are presenting it, it explains how to present the claims to each other, and it says that they should use participating providers or licensed mental health, licensed doctors, dentists, and mental health providers in all respects where they can. In other words, use licensed professionals. And Judge Burns said that includes licensed mental health professionals. So we have, starting with the decree, Mr. Becker's continued payment of these expenses up to this point, and his retaining of reimbursements for these expenses that he now claims he shouldn't have to pay, but he's kept $25,000 of the reimbursement. I believe I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have time for rebuttal. 1 minute and 26 seconds, Mr. Astley.
And Mr. Chief, thank you. I would respectfully ask the court for an additional minute and 30 seconds because counsel raised the insurance issue after her time had run.
You may have that amount.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
Our timer a second here to get that in. Minutes and 51 seconds, Mr. Astley.
All right. Thank you very much, Your Honor. I'd like to begin by answering Justice Miller Lerman's question directly, which is that on page 21 of the transcript, the original decree very clearly defines the narrow scope of medical expenses, which are subject to reimbursement. It states that Mark is responsible for 90% of medical, dental, and optical expenses for the child that are not reimbursed by insurance in excess of $480 per child per year, which was the then existing threshold. That's what it says. Now, in terms of counsel's argument that we somehow ambushed or surprised them with this appeal, we addressed in our reply brief, I tried to find it while dividing my attention with counsel's argument. I couldn't find it, but our reply brief is short. I point out to the court in our reply brief where we confirmed with Sonia Becker that the medical pay clause in the decree was the sole basis for the contempt that is under appeal here, where we confronted her with her own lawyer's closing argument taking the contrary legal position. And it's interesting because there's this painful exchange in the courtroom where counsel and Sonia Becker then try to disavow their own letter that they sent to the court in the prior case. And on the verge of me asking the court to swear in opposing counsel as a witness, they finally concede that the letter can simply be marked as an exhibit and adopted. And I think that is really consistent with our opposition's MO in this portion of the case and in other portions of the case, which is it is just obstruction after obstruction, trying to hide the fact that they've taken these legally inconsistent positions. This is not a due process issue. We confronted them with it. We gave them the opportunity to say anything they want to about it. But the fact remains, Sonia Becker only escaped being held in contempt on this because she had to convince the district court that there was no illness, injury, or medical problem. She asserted that, her lawyer asserted that, the district court adopted that, and now she wants us to be responsible for an expense under the medical expense clause. And it is simply impossible for a child to not have a medical problem and for the parent of that child to owe a medical expense. Because of that, I think that this is a very compelling case for this court to say enough is enough. You can't argue that the facts and in fact the legal conclusion is one way in the first case and that it's a different way in the second case. I want to spend my last time talking about these insurance checks.
Is it your position that it was insurance fraud to submit the claim? And then if it was, why is your client retaining the money?
We don't believe it was insurance fraud, although that's not necessarily a question that I think has a bearing over whether Mark Becker is in contempt, because that's the issue that was before the court.
I was speaking more to the question of whether people were taking inconsistent positions out of convenience.
Sonia Becker is the one who submitted those claims to the insurance company. They did send the checks to him. I don't recall.
He sent them right back and say, these aren't medical expenses. You ought not pay these.
He did not do that. Instead, when the daughter came home from camp, he gave a portion of the payments to his daughter. And unfortunately, Your Honor, that is in the record, but I can't recall how much or what percentage of it was. But he did give a portion of the payments to his daughter. But I agree with you that he did not send the checks back to the insurance company and refused the payment. But the question of whether those are owed under the policy's contract language is a different question as to whether he's in willful contempt for not reimbursing Sonia Becker, given the inconsistent position that she took on the very same subject matter in front of the same judge. Unless the court has any further questions, I thank you for your time and I thank you for the accommodation to appear via WebEx. It's been very helpful to me and the folks who've been traveling with me.
Thank you very much. And that concludes arguments in this case and for the day. So the court is adjourned and counsel, you are excused. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.